Good Thursday evening. It is August 13th, 2020, and this is Ozarks at Large on 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. Ahead on tonight's show, a new book to help the youngest Arkansas students understand the different environment at school that awaits them. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda talks with a co-author of My Teacher Wears a Mask, and we'll also learn why Hendricks College is going virtual this fall. There are 652 new cases of COVID-19 in Arkansas, and the Arkansas Department of Health is announcing an additional 9 deaths from the virus. That brings the state's death toll to 582. Governor Hutchinson says the latest reporting of new cases in Arkansas is a decrease compared to yesterday.
We hope that that trend can continue, but we know that there is nothing guaranteed. Just because you start a trend does not mean that trend is going to continue. But it is a good place to start, and it all depends upon individual actions of people in Arkansas. That's really what it depends upon, in addition to the contact tracing and the results of the work of the Department of Health.
Also at today's press briefing, Governor Hutchinson announced the number of Arkansans hospitalized because of coronavirus decreased by 23. It's the second consecutive day that hospitalizations from the virus were reduced by more than 20. Nearly 5,200 test results came in during the past 24-hour monitoring period. That's an increase of about 1,100 compared to the previous 24 hours. And with the start of school 11 days away, the governor says a partnership between Arkansas Children's, the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences, and the state's Departments of Education and Health put together a guide to better communicate with parents and educators best practices for attending school in person. Dr. Cam Patterson, the chancellor of UAMS, says a new guide, Arkansas Ready to Learn Healthy School Guide, released today, provides the latest scientific information to help families prepare for in-person classes.
This is written in lay terms and provides a variety of best practices that have been established in a data-driven fashion for creating a healthy K-12 environment for our students and our teachers.
Dr. Patterson says the document is not designed to guide whether or not schools should reopen, but should be looked at as guidance for families and educators to make the best choices for a most unusual school start. He also says the guides and related documents might change as more is learned about the virus.
This is clearly an evolving situation, and we consider these documents to be living documents. They will be revised as additional information and science is made available.
The guide is available online and can be found by entering Arkansas Ready to Learn Guide into a search engine. Ivy Pfeffer, Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Education, says additional resources about social and emotional support will be released soon for schools. She says the recently established call center for parents with questions about the upcoming school year is receiving between 30 and 40 calls a day.
Every question that we get is logged. Every answer is recorded and then made available to the person who called in. And we are constantly adjusting our approach and our information to be sure that we're meeting the needs. So the calls and the questions that are coming from you are really helping to drive the next step supports that we provide.
As of this afternoon, the Arkansas Department of Health reports more than 6,700 active cases of COVID-19 in Arkansas, with just more than 5,900 of those cases categorized as community cases. The governor's press briefings are archived in their entirety at the governor's YouTube page. This is Ozarks at Large. A half dozen white nationalist billboards have been erected in Harrison in Boone County since 2013. As Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, in recent weeks, more than 8,800 supporters have signed a Change.org petition to have the last standing panel advertising a Ku Klux Klan White Pride internet broadcast be removed.
After Harrison's long-established African-American neighborhood was destroyed by a white mob in the early 20th century, blacks have avoided visiting or even driving through Harrison. That is, until the Harrison Community Task Force on Race Relations, formed in 2003 by local church leaders and the town mayor, worked to repair the city's racist legacy. Elizabeth Darden's ancestors settled in Ponca, south of Harrison, in the early 1800s. She joined the task force in 2008.
I'm an educator, a mother of three biracial children in this community.
And Darden, 2 weeks ago, initiated a change.org petition titled Take Down This Billboard.
Yes. We are upset about the billboard because it gives the connotation that this is what this community is all about. It's a false representation of the majority here. Racism, white supremacy, it's unacceptable to me and most of us here.
The billboard advertises White Pride Internet Radio, where local Knights Party Ku Klux Klan leader Tom Robb, who resides in rural Boone County, and colleagues proselytize that the white race is in danger of going extinct due to race mixing.
White pride is a term with a very ugly meaning, especially from the viewpoint of those who have been oppressed. Because I know for a long time, people in this community do not approve of that. You know, there's a minority that speaks very loud. We don't want to be silent anymore. We want to speak up and use our voice. And I feel like we've provided a platform now for people to do so.
Darden says she aims to collect 50,000 signatures.
We just hope that the overwhelming voice of our community will be heard by the owners of this sign and be persuaded that this message is hurtful to our community, morally, culturally, and economically.
A half dozen racist billboards have been erected around Harrison since 2013, advertising things like diversity is white genocide and anti-racist is a code word for anti-white. But due to pressure applied by the task force and concerned community members, all but one hate billboard remains. Darden's change.org petition specifically targets Claude West, owner of Pro Signs Incorporated, doing business as Harrison Sign Company, and his silent partner, developer David Fry, CFO of Roche Coleman Homes, lives in Fayetteville. West, who claims he lives in Harrison, defends the billboard and others he's erected in town since 2017, refusing to infringe on his client's free speech.
You may not like what I say, I may not like what you say, but I'm going to respect the First Amendment.
West claims he's been harassed and physically threatened because of the billboards.
Now, I've even had someone come in my office, lean over my desk, and then they call every one of my customers, and that I'm a racist.
Sir, are you a white supremacist?
Why would you even think that?
Because you're advertising white supremacy.
I've advertised all both sides of the political on my billboards also. Does that make me a Democrat or Republican? And I'm also a minority. So, you know, if you want to go by words and what's right and everything, go by that. They're going after a minority business.
Minority business? What do you mean, sir?
I'm Hispanic. Is that not minority?
West says he's met with city leaders and task force members, most recently in July, but claims no one has issued a formal letter asking him to take down the billboard. In an email response for this report, Task Force Chair Lane Ragsdale writes that if the city, county, or chamber were to issue such a letter, West would immediately file suit, alleging suppression of his First Amendment rights. But Ragsdale says a petition, which is accumulating thousands of signatures each week, constitutes a formal written request for removal. Until recently, West owned a triangle of land where the billboard stands. We asked him who he sold the parcel to, and if that individual might remove the billboard.
That is none of your business or anyone's.
According to land records, local attorney Jason Robb, son of local Ku Klux Klan leader Tom Robb, paid $25,000 for the parcel. Jason Robb appears on his father's White Pride internet broadcasts. He also advertises his practice adjacent to the White Pride billboard as attorney of record for the KKK, says Kelsey Bardwell, who located the land transaction. She and Kathy Golden are attorneys with Harrison Law Firm Sprott, Golden, and Bardwell. They've represented the Harrison Task Force on Race Relations for 5 years, and on behalf of the nonprofit, issued a letter to Claude West to take the billboard down.
Claude West responded to the task force letter that he is entitled to make a living.
Nothing happened until a controversial white vlogger, Rob Bliss from L.A., stood in Harrison for several days in July posing as a Black Lives Matter protester. He held a Black Lives Matter sign to elicit and record hateful comments. He cut all positive comments and compressed it into a 2-minute video.
Harrison, Arkansas is the most racist town in the United States.
Have a little pride, you're race, brother!
Hey, all lives matter, not just black.
Apparently, black people's lives matter more than us.
That sensational video has gone viral, attracting millions of clicks and cash for Bliss, casting Harrison as the most hateful town in America. This is Kelsey Bardwell.
Because of the recent video that went viral from our town, we believe that the billboard is used to recruit people who are sympathetic to their cause through the internet. And so we want to get it down. We want businesses to be able to come to Harrison without fear for any employees that they want to move here. And we're sick of taking the blame for the billboard when it's owned by people who don't live here.
Referring to Claude West, partner David Fry, and longtime racist billboard advertiser, KKK leader Tom Robb. Kelsey Bardwell says they've tried to reason with West over the years.
We're just kind of done with that. And so as far as our involvement, we advise the task force when they have ideas. And their approach is always to be peaceful, to be polite. We've approached Mr. Fry and Mr. West cordially, politely in the past, and it's not worked. And so the task force is ready to get the public's input as well. And that's why they started the petition.
Bardwell and Golden rarely speak to media about the controversial billboards, which have plagued the community for 7 years, although they've assisted the task force in convincing various property owners about restricting unwelcoming billboards in recent lease agreements with any sign company.
Kathy Golden, and I'm proud to say that since then there have been no more billboards go up. This one that is up now, that we're struggling with now because of the fact that it's owned by this particular group, is our last struggle, we think. There have been no more.
Task Force member and Change.org petition author Elizabeth Darden says she's taking a last stand.
Right now, this is the last standing hateful billboard in this community, and we're just doing what we can to attempt to get that removed.
Conversely, the Community Task Force on Race Relations pays for the placement of neighborly welcoming billboards around Harrison to combat hate and undo the town's racist reputation. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
Hendricks College is a small private school with a residential campus in Conway that 1,100 students call home in a normal year. Here's Terry Bonebright, the Vice President for Academic Affairs and College Provost.
We really pride ourselves on having the residential experience for students where they are engaged both in really terrific in-person classes as well as opportunities both on and on campus that really accentuate and build on the classroom experience.
Peter Gass, who is the Associate Provost for Engaged Learning, as well as the school's COVID response coordinator, says at first the college had every intention of reopening with in-person classes this fall.
We were very confident in that plan for all the factors we could manage internally. So systems in place, you know, doing our own contact tracing, isolation and quarantine protocol. However, it was the external factors outside of our control that ultimately led to this decision.
Those factors included increasing COVID-19 cases and positivity rate, as well as inconsistent testing turnaround times, making it difficult to commit to effective contact tracing and quarantining to manage the virus on campus. Guest says Hendricks might be a small school, but that didn't make the decision to go fully virtual in the fall any easier.
Whether it's a big state university or a small residential liberal arts, we all want our students on campus. We thrive, and both Terry and I are, you know, members of the faculty as well. And we we thrive being in front of a classroom and moving in physical space with our students and interacting with them. And, you know, that's what Hendrix does really, really well. So that was a really hard part of the decision to move away from that to remote.
He says he's impressed with his colleagues who have responded with innovation and creativity to reach their students. And Terry Bonebright adds, student attitudes are also making the transition easier.
People do understand that the decision really was driven by what we felt we needed to do to really protect people's health. And, you know, we know that there will come a point where we will be able to come back in person. And, we will all look forward to that time.
Until then, Guest says the college plans to go virtual with as many campus life events as it can.
For example, we have a great what we call Thursday Forum. It's faculty and students come together to talk about a current topic. It is really an open discussion that's done in a room off of our dining hall, typically. Well, there's no reason that can't be just as effective on a virtual platform. And so we will be having, you know, virtual social events, all kinds of opportunities for clubs to meet, that sort of thing.
College leaders will also continue to monitor community cases of COVID-19, the positivity rate, and the testing turnaround times.
And if it gets to a point where we feel like those are headed in the right direction so that we can open safely, then we will. That could happen this fall. We hope it happens this fall. And if not, certainly spring. So as you might expect, as we're planning for a virtual beginning to the fall, we're simultaneously planning for that time when we can bring students back in person.
Since students are not living on campus, they will not have to pay for room and board. And Bonebright says the college has also lowered tuition. While that means taking a financial hit, she adds that it's something the school was prepared for.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. Arkansas PBS presents Blueberries Clubhouse each Friday, now through August 14th at 10 a.m. Kids can learn and explore the natural state in this original series. Plus, activities will be shared each day on Facebook through August 14th. Details available at myarkansaspbs.org.
Just ahead on Ozarks at Large, just how bad was the economy in the second quarter? That's part of today's Northwest Arkansas Business Journal report with Paul Gatling in just a moment. Talk Business and Politics reports any decision on changing the name of Albert Pike Elementary School in Fort Smith will come after the public has had more time to offer opinions. Talk Business reports Fort Smith School Board tabled the resolution to change the school's name, and the item is now on the August 24th agenda for the board. Pike, who lived in Fort Smith, served as a Confederate Army general. A petition for the name change also quotes writings from Pike after the Civil War that the white race alone should govern the United States. The August 24th meeting is scheduled to begin at 5:30 in the auditorium of the School Service Center on Jenny Lind Road. The summer book sale continues at the Fort Smith Museum of History. You can check out the complete list and books of local history, historical fiction, biography, Native American history, Black history, women's history, children's books, books compiled for research, Arkansas regional and Ozark history, and more at fortsmithmuseum.org. 91.3 KUAF provides information about our area throughout the day, not just during Ozarks at Large. For example, each weekday morning at 5:30 and 7:30, we have newscasts about the region, and you can also follow how coronavirus is affecting all of us at our COVID-19 update page that you can find at KUAF.com. And throughout the day, you can hear information, public service announcements, and more on KUAF 91.3.
Welcome to today's Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. I'm Paul Gatling. Economist Mervyn Jebaraj, who heads up the Center for Business and Economic Research at the University of Arkansas, says the doom and gloom expected in the second quarter lived up to its billing. And he warned more financial turmoil is in store without an agreement on a new pandemic package from Congress. Roby Brock has more with Jebaraj on today's program. Plus, who is the female founder who has raised the most funding in Arkansas? For the answer to that question, we look to Bentonville. We'll have those stories and more after a quick timeout on this edition of the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report.
Support for the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report is provided by the Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries of Arkansas. The Chamber's mission is to promote a pro-business, free enterprise agenda and prevent legislation, regulation, and rules that hinder business. ArkansasStateChamber.com. Arkansas Blue Cross and Blue Shield. For more than 70 years, Arkansas Blue Cross and Blue Shield has used its knowledge and compassion to create healthcare solutions for individuals and businesses. More information at ArkansasBlueCross.com. First Security is proud to be only in Arkansas. They offer smart solutions for personal and business banking, plus convenient services and community investment. First Security, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
The first look at the country's GDP for the second quarter came out last week at a staggering 32.9% decline on an annualized basis. So just how bad is that number? For some perspective, Talk Business and Politics Editor-in-Chief Roby Brock caught up with University of Arkansas economist Mervin Jebaraj to discuss.
I think if you were to look for any silver lining in any of this report was that we were fully expecting a horrible second quarter report, and we got a horrible second quarter report. So on a seasonally adjusted annualized basis is how the BEA does this. The economy did decline about 33%. To keep in mind here that since it's annualized, the BEA's calculation implies that if the economy the entire year was like the second quarter, then the entire year's economy would decline about 33%. So, on almost a slightly better measure that we're not traditionally using in this country because we don't have these wild swings from quarter to quarter, is to simply look at each quarter's change from the previous quarter. So in that particular metric, which we traditionally don't use, the GDP declined about 9.5% as opposed to the annualized figure, which was about 33%. So the 9.5% puts us about in line with most of the major Western economies, most of the major developed economies around the world.
Jebaraj says the $600 unemployment benefit supplement that ended July 31st after months of stimulating the economy was very effective in keeping the economy from cratering further. He said, though, that the narrative that the supplement disincentivized workers to return to jobs may not sync with actual data and logic.
So I think every one of us has probably heard at least one anecdote, if not multiple anecdotes, of people saying, oh, well, I'm not getting people to work, or people saying they will not go back to work because the unemployment boost is a better financial deal for them than going back to work. And for a long time, all we had was to deal with the, just look at the anecdotes. But in the last month, at least in July, we've seen several studies come out that indicate that on aggregate, the unemployment boost, the $600 per week additional unemployment boost, has not been a work disincentive. In fact, of all the people that went back to work in May and in June, 70% of them were on unemployment benefits, making more on unemployment benefits than they made at their jobs that they returned to in May and June. And I think, when you consider why workers might go back to work and give up their unemployment boost, there are a couple of reasons. One is because if your employer calls you back and you refuse to go, in most cases, your unemployment benefits get cut off. Secondly, even if there are, some exceptions around there, workers would rather have the permanence of a job than the temporary benefit of an unemployment benefit that they know will expire at some point. Now, I think most people were not expecting it to expire in the last week of July and thought that it would last longer, but it has expired in the last week of July. And as a result, workers, when they're making longer-term decisions, know that at some point their unemployment benefits will be cut off, even if it wasn't going to be the end of July. And that when they have to return to the workforce, they're not going to return to a workforce that looked like it was in February with a really low unemployment rate and a lot of competition for jobs. Whenever we do get back all the workers to the workforce or try to get as many workers to the workforce, our employment rate is not going to get back to those record lows until 2021, late 2021, or maybe even 2022. So workers are going to come back to a much more difficult job market. So they would rather take the permanence of a job and the temporary boost of $600 per week in unemployment benefits. So you know, what we've seen repeatedly from different studies, at least on aggregate, is that people are not using the $600 per week unemployment benefit as a disincentive to work. When they are called back, logically, they are going back. And at the end of the day, the reason why the unemployment rate is as high as it is to this day is because there simply aren't jobs coming back. We've lost millions of jobs. We've made back a small portion of them, again, in large part because of the PPP loans, a lot of which expires again in the end of July or in a couple of weeks. And those workers are coming back off companies' payrolls. So the unemployment rate is probably going to tick up some more. And all of that is going to be in sort of this environment where there's uncertainty about where unemployment benefits are going. Congress obviously knew that the deadline was the end of July. They set that deadline in March. And so they've had time to deal with it. State unemployment systems are clearly not nimble. They're archaic. So even if Congress today decided to extend unemployment benefits, it'll be a week or more before they can actually extend those unemployment benefits. And a one-month cutoff in unemployment benefits will reduce the size of the U.S. economy by about 4.3%, at least the consumer side of it.
And that's Mervin Jebarash, who is the director of the Center for Business and Economic Research at the University of Arkansas. He's a frequent contributor on Talk Business and Politics, and if you don't have your DVR set, you can catch that show each Sunday morning at 10:30 on our content partner, KFSM TV Channel 5. In other news this week, the Springdale City Council approved Tuesday an ordinance to temporarily establish the downtown Springdale Outdoor Dining District for 6 months. The entertainment district will allow those who are at least 21 to consume alcoholic beverages while within its boundaries. Analysts say that America's Car-Mart will report a nearly 35% drop in earnings per share in the first quarter of fiscal 2021. The Buy Here, Pay Here used car dealer will report earnings after the markets close on Monday. Little Rock-based contractor Baldwin & Shell Construction Company has moved its Northwest Arkansas division office from Rogers into a new building in the Harbor Meadows area of Springdale. It's a homecoming of sorts for the firm, which opened its first Northwest Arkansas office on Springdale's Emma Avenue in 1990. And who is the female founder who has raised the most funding in Arkansas? According to London-based Business Financing, the answer to that question is an entrepreneur who works in Bentonville. April Segerbrook, who's helped software firm Movista raise $13.3 million in funding, tops the Arkansas list. Business Financing is a business finance and lending research and information website publisher that recently compiled a list of founders with the most funding in all 50 states. Segerbrook and Stan Zalowski founded Movista in 2010. The company's cloud-based software allows companies to manage their distributed workforces via smart devices. And you'll find those stories and more online at nwabusinessjournal.com, where you can keep up with business headlines each and every day. And that's your Northwest Arkansas Business Journal report. Until next time, I'm Paul Gatling. Thanks for listening.
This is Ozarks at Large. Children preparing to head back to school for in-person instruction will be entering a new learning environment. They're likely to see desks spaced out in classrooms, extra bottles of hand sanitizer, and teachers wearing masks. To help little ones cope with the newness and strangeness that may come with having an instructor with a partially covered face, Arkansas State University Childhood Services and the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences partnered to create an informational book called My Teacher Wears a Mask. This month, Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda spoke via Zoom with Nikki Edge, co-author and professor in the Family Medicine Department at UAMS, about what prompted her and her colleagues to create the book earlier this year.
Our inspiration was really some of our early care and education partners, teachers who learned about new regulations that would require them to wear masks in the classroom for everyone's safety, of course. And while many of the teachers obviously knew and understood the reasons, they were worried about how some of the children would react. Would it be scary or confusing for some of them? We know that young kids can be really easily confused by changes in appearance. If you look on YouTube, you see all kinds of videos of young kids who don't recognize their dad after he shaves his beard. And so kids can be really easily confused. And so teachers were expressing, you know, how do we help them get ready for this, adapt to this? And one of the best ways that we help kids adapt to a change in routine or to something new is with books. And so we wanted to write a little book that is a particular kind of book called A Social Story that is designed to help kids learn new rules, learn new routines, orient them to some new information.
Have any of your personal reactions with kids and how they've reacted to adults wearing masks help influence the messages in this book?
Absolutely. What we find is that it's so varied. Some children just don't seem phased at all, as if they hardly notice. And then other times, you know, it's a toddler who won't come out from behind their parents' legs when they see somebody in a mask, and they really don't know what they're looking at. They don't know if they're looking at something scary. They don't know if they're looking at a stranger. And sometimes it depends on context too. Like, it's okay if I see someone in the grocery store with a mask because I'm safe here with my parents, but don't try to leave me with that person, you know? And so I think it just depends. It's very wide ranging.
So how is the book structured? It's a social story, so to help kids learn, but it's also this resource for parents and teachers.
That's right. So it's structured as a book for kids that parents and teachers can use to orient them to some basic mask concepts, what masks are, the reasons that we wear them, some ideas about that they're safe and not scary. And we introduced some ideas about ways that we can still read emotion, even with masks on. And then there's a play mask in the back that you can cut out, make as many copies of that as they want. Kids can kind of really explore a mask that way, use it with their toys, use it with their teddy bear. And there's some activities in the back that teachers or parents can use to help kids just explore mask concepts further, even with, you know, the younger toddlers, even older infants. We have an activity for young children, and then we have activities for older kids where, again, we play around with the idea that we can still read feelings in people's eyes, and they can make feelings faces and play feeling charades with their mask on. So it's just some fun activities that parents can explore, depending, again, on what their child's needs are, the questions their child has, or how their child is reacting.
Teaching them to not be scared or to feel safe is a big part of this. How do you do that?
So a lot of it has to do with how the parents react themselves and how the parents approach it. So one thing we're encouraging to do is have parents download the book, explore the book in advance so that they've gone over some of those basic concepts about masks with their child. And that way, when they go in on that first day, they can make the connection for the child. Oh, look, Miss Sheila is wearing a mask just like we read about in the book. She's wearing a mask to keep us safe. Miss Sheila is safe. And just using those safety words, drawing that connection for the child, thanking the teacher in front of the child for wearing a mask to keep everyone safe. And so just sort of acting like this is normal. We're grateful to Miss Sheila for wearing the mask. And if the parent's reaction is positive, then that will help, I think, allay the concerns of the child. But I think that the more the child kind of knows and understands and is prepared in advance, the easier that first day will be if they are anxious about it.
Have you noticed any changes personally to the way children are reacting to masks these past few months now that it has become more widespread that people are wearing it out in public all the time?
Yes, I think that it is becoming more normal. You see more and more kids around wearing masks. And so I think it's just that comfort that comes with familiarity. And so one thing that's different is that even though kids are getting more used to seeing masks, they're not used to seeing them on the person that's caring for them in their home. So if they are going to go back into childcare or going back into kindergarten and be cared for by someone with a mask, that can still feel like a little bit of a different experience. And so even if your child is kind of getting used to seeing masks around in the community, sometimes it can't hurt to just go ahead and prepare them for the idea that the caregiver, the person that they might already know and love, but now not recognize, you know, is still the person that they know and love and is safe, or this new teacher that they don't know at all is still safe and that it will be fine for mom and dad to leave you.
Since publishing the book earlier this summer, have you come across anything in conversation that maybe would be a good concept to add, maybe in an updated version or anything like that?
We've been asked for many things from our colleagues. We've been asked about a book about wearing a mask, you know, for the children themselves now that many, the regulations vary school by school, but in many schools, children that are in kindergarten, first, second grade may be wearing masks themselves. So understanding mask rules and how mask works, that may be a need that we have. We have also been asked about maybe a book about if schools don't get to stay open, what does it look like to stay connected to our school family, even when we're not together every day in the classroom. So we may be, we may find ourselves needing a book series to help us cope with COVID over the long run. But this was a good place to start.
That was Nikki Edge, a professor in UAMS's Family Medicine Department and co-author of the book, My Teacher Wears a Mask. She spoke with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda via Zoom earlier this month. The book can be downloaded at asuchildhoodservices.org. We'll also post that link on our website, ozarksatlarge.com.
1, 2, 1, 2, 3.
This is Leah Uribe, Associate Professor at the University of Arkansas Music Department, expanding our musical boundaries with Sound Perimeter. Imani Winds, a Grammy-nominated ensemble, started in 2000 as a group of friends, classically trained musicians of color, determined to make a statement about representation in the arts and determined to be role models for children and young musicians that look like them. Since its beginning, Imani Winds has led both a revolution and the evolution of the Wind Quintet through their dynamic playing, adventurous programming, imaginative collaborations, and outreach endeavors that have inspired audiences of all ages and backgrounds. That was Imani Winds interpreting excerpts from composer Valerie Coleman's piece, Portraits of Josephine Baker, First Movement All St. Louis, a musical memoir dedicated to Josephine Baker, an American-born French entertainer, French resistance agent, and civil rights activist. The four-movement work, written by former Imani Wynne flutist Valerie Coleman, chronicles Baker's life, humor, and quick rise to fame. Imani Wynne is committed to education and participates in residencies through the U.S., giving performances and master classes to thousands of students each year. Academic and institutional residencies include the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center, Duke University, the University of Chicago, Curtis Institute of Music, the University of Michigan, the Camera of Houston, and numerous others across the country. We in Fayetteville have been touched by their mission, too. Imani visited us in 2017, brought by the Walton Arts Center for a concert with composer Edward Simon and Afinidad. While here, Imani visited schools and worked with our University of Arkansas Music Department students, and it was a very inspiring experience for all. That was Imani Wynne in performance with Afinidad, representing the jazz and classical worlds, respectively, fulfilling composer Edward Simon's goal of integrating orchestral instruments into a jazz setting. Afinidad featured Simon on piano alongside with saxophonist David Binney, bassist Scott Colley, and drummer Brian Blake. Imani Wynne, flutist Brandon Patrick George, oboist Toyin Spellman-Diaz, French hornist Jeff Scott, clarinetist Mark Dover, and bassoonist Monica Ellis are committed to traditional chamber music repertoire and, as a 21st century group, also to expanding the Wynne Quintet repertoire by commissioning music from new voices that reflect historical events and the times in which we currently live. In the wake of race equity conversations after the killing of George Floyd, Imani Wynne's musicians Toyin Spellman-Diaz and Monica Ellis have participated in several panels addressing their experiences as Black musicians. If interested in these conversations, you will find some links to those panels in the program notes. So much work to do, and so many amazing and awesome musicians fighting out there for social justice with their strongest and most beautiful tool, their music, and their ability to change dynamics in their own platforms. We close this segment today with American modernist composer Elliot Carter's Woodwind Quintet, written in 1948, performed by Imani Wynne. This is Leah Uribe, Associate Professor at the University of Arkansas Music Department, expanding our musical boundaries with Sound Perimeter.
This is Ozarks at Large. The Oklahoma State Department of Health this morning is reporting 11 additional deaths from the virus that have been added to the state's total. Two of those deaths occurred in the past 24 hours. 638 Oklahomans have now died from the virus. The state late this morning reported just more than 700 new cases diagnosed in the past 24 hours. And the State Department of Health in Oklahoma says 600 people are in Oklahoma hospitals because of complications from coronavirus. That's the highest number of Oklahomans in hospitals in a week's time. Tomorrow on Ozarks at Large, Michael Tilley with our partner Talk Business and Politics will help us review some of the news of the past 7 days. Becca Martin Brown, the features editor at the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette, will be with us to explain how the Shiloh Museum of Ozark History in Springdale, drag queens, the Arkansas Air and Military Museum, and others continue to present arts and culture as the pandemic stretches into a sixth month. And Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis will talk with the band Route 358 about their brand new CD. And we'll hear samples from the CD as well. That and more on tomorrow's Ozarks at Large at noon and 7 on 91.3 KUAF.
That's Bix Beiderbecke's composition, In a Mist, performed by Wayne Wallace. And I'm Robert Ginsberg, your host for Shades of Jazz. We'll hear more from Wayne Wallace, as well as Stan Getz, Charlie Hunter, Jason Moran, and Jason Marsalis. Shades of Jazz, every Friday and Saturday, right here on KUAF 91.3 FM.
Shades of Jazz with Robert Ginsberg, first airing tomorrow night from 10 to midnight here on 91.3 FM KUAF. Then again Saturday morning, beginning at 11, lasting until 1 Saturday afternoon on KUAF 3. KUAF's locally produced music programs like Shades of Jazz and Generic Blues Show and The Pick and Post, Jazz Scoop and KUAF Vinyl Hour, they all air twice each weekend, first on 91.3, then encore daytime broadcasts throughout the weekend on KUAF 3, one of our HD signals. You can hear KUAF 3 and our 24-hour classical music station KUAF 2 on your HD radio, either in your car or at home. You can also go to KUAF.com to find those signals, or you can ask your smart speaker to play KUAF 2 or play KUAF 3. And you can find schedules for all of the station's weekend programming, including 91.3, at KUAF.com. By the way, tomorrow, 91.3 will bring you again live coverage of Governor Asa Hutchinson's coronavirus press briefing. That's scheduled to start at 1:30 tomorrow. This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, Stillwell, Oklahoma. 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Contributors to this Thursday night show included Jacqueline Froelich, Antoinette Grajeda, Zuzanna Sitek, who delivered news and sound about Hendricks College going virtual this fall, and Leah Rebe. Timothy Dennis produced and engineered the show tonight. Lee Wood produced tonight's Sound Perimeter segment. Classical music for KUAF comes from the Highlands Oncology Music Library at KUAF. And the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report with Paul Gatling and Roby Brock, part of our partnership with Talk Business and Politics. Our theme is titled First Hurrah. It is written and performed by Daryl Sean. Daryl's most recent CD is titled Safe in Sound. You can find it at all the usual music streaming services. Thanks so much for being with us from the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio at the Carver Center for Public Radio in downtown Fayetteville. I'm Kyle Kellums. Please be well. We'll be back with you tomorrow at noon.